Welcome to Buddha at the Gas Pump. My name is Rick Archer, and my guest this week is Jim Flanagan. And if you're watching this as a video as opposed to listening to it, or even if you're listening to it, you may notice that there's something different about this week's show. And that is that we're recording the whole thing on Skype, which, as most of you may know, is a video recording service that you can use for free to have video conferences with people on the internet. And all sorts of professional shows do it these days. Oprah is always having people on with Skype and CNN and so on. And so why not us? This is a trial run, and hopefully you'll get good audiovisual quality out of it. As you probably also know, if you've been following this show, the topic of the show is that we have a discussion with someone each week who has had a spiritual awakening, and people like to use different terminology for that, so we'll let Jim Flanagan use his own. The implication of the title of this series is that states of consciousness or awakening or whatever we would like to call them, which were previously thought to be kind of beyond the reach of ordinary people and which were the sole province of, you know, historical figures or, you know, great even contemporary saints, are becoming relatively commonplace. More and more people are experiencing essentially the same thing as any enlightened person in history has experienced. Maybe they don't have the same role to play in the world as someone who, you know, made a huge splash 2,000 or 2,500 years ago, but that is not to say that their subjective experience is not of the same quality or the same nature. Now, Jim and I don't think have ever met face to face, but we have been co-participants for many years in several different internet chat groups. In one of them, it's sort of amusing. I mean, Jim caught a lot of flack. This is a group called Fairfield Life, which I founded nearly 10 years ago. Whenever anyone came in there and made the claim or the statement that he was experiencing some higher state of consciousness, several people jumped all over him, because it was the mindset of certain participants in that forum that, as I was just suggesting, such states are not really accessible to the common man. And so the implication of anyone claiming to have experienced them or to be experiencing them would be that the person is on some kind of ego trip or self-deluded or whatever. And I thought that Jim always handled it with a great deal of patience and perseverance and did his best to respond to these people in a patient manner. More recently, Jim has been participating more actively in a chat group associated with this show, Buddha the Gas Pump chat group, which I'll tell you a little bit later how to find a link to. There, the audience is much more friendly. They hasn't had that problem. So, Jim, let me turn our discussion to you a little bit. I don't know a lot about you. I guess you live in the Bay Area someplace. You're some kind of computer expert. Why don't you give us a little biographical sketch, and then we'll do the more spiritual stuff.
Sure thing. So I was born in California 55 years ago, and at the age of 3 months, went off to Southeast Asia. My dad was with the Foreign Service, and I spent the next 20 years primarily in Southeast Asia, a little bit of time in Spain, and so on. So lots and lots of very rich experiences, some good, some bad, of course. So I do now live in Santa Clara, California, part of the San Francisco Bay Area, and I work as a technical training manager. Basically manage groups that teach people how to use computers.
Cool. You're also a musical composer. Jim composes this very interesting electronic music, and I believe you have an album coming out or something, CD, don't you?
I do, actually. So my artist name is Temple Dog. Uh-huh. I have four albums out now. I think three of them are available on iTunes, and then I just released a fourth one through, I guess you could call it my publishing company, CD Baby. Uh-huh. Not spelled S-E-E-D-Y, baby, which I actually prefer, but C-D is in compact disc.
Maybe we can actually put a sample of one of your songs on the Buddha at the Gas Pump blog, and people can get a taste of it, and then they could go to iTunes and download some if they wanted to. So, Jim, what is your spiritual background? I mean, when did you first become interested in spirituality?
All that kind of stuff?
Enlightenment, that
right.
Kind of thing.
You know, I don't know. I always had sort of a perspective that was more oriented that way than anything else. And, I'd read books when I was in high school. I remember doing a cartoon strip for the high school alternative newspaper called The Cosmic Void. So I obviously had some awareness or interest in that sort of thing. Oh, and I was a an altar boy, actually, when I was part of the Episcopalian Church, which was always a real spiritual experience for me. In fact, I remember it was funny, the priest telling me, don't bow so deeply when you, you know, approach the altar. And it was like, hey, but that's the point. You know? So anyway, so I kind of had that interest and so on. And then that really crystallized when I was around 21. I went to a couple of Buddhist things. I tried more guided meditations. And then I became interested in transcendental meditation because my girlfriend's mother had started, and she was effusive about it, and I thought, well, what the heck, you know, I was kind of into that space. And so I started when I was 21. I've continued to meditate twice a day for all of that time. And then I also ended up working for that movement for about 2 years and did a lot of what they call rounding courses. So we do a lot of meditation in the morning, a lot of meditation in the evening, and so on.
Remember the song Dear Prudence, the Beatles sang, look around, round, round. They were referring to that term, rounding.
Oh, okay.
Where you, that was the term that was used in the TM movement for doing long meditations throughout the day on those courses. You know, chart for us the timeline or the sequence of your kind of experiential unfolding through that.
I started TM, and I went through and got initiated at that point. It was close to one of the best experiences of my life. Just that learning for the first time. It was very innocent. Was able to find this kind of deep silence and bliss. I know a lot of people express it that way. And then the interesting thing about it was very carrot and stick, because that was probably the best experience I had for, I'd say, a good 5 years after that. You know, everything, you know, then it just kind of turned into this sort of mundane type thing. And continued to do it and so on, took some advanced courses, continued to do that. Now, when I took those advanced courses, I started to notice some really interesting things happening to me experientially. You know, things that I had read about, but really, I think what was going on was I was starting to shift out of a very academically structured understanding of spirituality and enlightenment and all these types of things. And I had really worked myself into that state as a result of having been exposed to so many countries and cultures and experiences and all this kind of thing, that the only way that I, and including spirituality, the only way I really could make sense of this was to try to have a reason and a story for everything that I experienced. Now, I didn't find out, you know, years later when I did some research into the ego and all this kind of thing. But, you know, the way those stories always worked is I always came out ahead. Example, if I had met you, Rick, and we were talking and you had said something and maybe it had caused some discomfort or provoked some kind of emotional reaction in me, I would then later make up a story about the occurrence to explain the discomfort that I was feeling at your expense. I was rationalizing everything. You know, for years and years and years, this went on, and I was pretty good. I've always had a pretty keen intellect. So, you know, the stories were legion, but I was managing to juggle them all for years and years and years. But the thing that I kept doing as well was I continued to meditate. So what this was doing was driving a cognitive dissonance between what I was thinking was going on and what was actually going on. Uh-huh. And in point of fact, you know, I thought all of this spiritual stuff was happening to me, but if I ever happened to sit for a minute quietly, I realized that I was miserable. You know, I was one miserable because I was so isolated. You know, I had made up all these stories to push away everybody and leave me at kind of the top of the heap. Well, whether you're at the top of the heap or, you know, lonely place. So I happened to inadvertently create a very uncomfortable space for myself.
Was this something that you think you had been doing all of your life, or was it something you started doing after you learned to meditate? You picked up this new habit of rationalizing and making yourself look good.
Like I said, once I looked into the ego, I realized, yeah, that's what the ego does, is it makes up stories at everyone else's expense, you know, sort of to glorify oneself or whatever. So I think that had been going on to some degree, but then when I got into TM and began investigating these sort of seven states of consciousness and higher states of consciousness, then I would carefully watch my experiences. And whenever I had something that could be deemed, you know, cosmic consciousness or God consciousness, and just for listeners, so cosmic consciousness would be an experience of witnessing. In other words, when I felt I was identified with that silent, unmoving part of myself, watching the rest of the world go on. Or God consciousness, which is an experience of subtle use of the senses, like, you know, oh, I could see into my body or somebody else's or something like that. Whenever I would have one of those experiences, I would immediately categorize them in terms of how much closer I was getting to being even more superior to others.
Interesting. I just happen to be reading a book right now. It takes me a long time to read a book because I don't have a lot of reading time, but it's called Halfway Up the Mountain, The Error of Premature Claims to Enlightenment by Mariana Kaplan. And she devotes a whole major section to the sort of egoic aggrandizement that some people fall prey to on the spiritual path, where they use their spiritual experiences as a way of bolstering their ego even more rather than sort of diminishing it and becoming more humble. So perhaps you're suggesting that's what you were going through.
I think unquestionably. Now, I mean, I wasn't externally an arrogant person. I've always been somebody that tries to get along with others and stuff. But I did feel a deep isolation as this process continued between myself and other people, you know, naturally.
I presume you got over it. You wouldn't be telling us about it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was the thing, you know, is this process continued to be driven so that here I thought I was at the top of the mountain, and yet I was I think my heart was very lonely, actually. You know, I think it was a terribly lonely experience. Until another way is presented, what is there to do except use the intellect and the sense of self to try to progress in life, I suppose. And other areas of my life had progressed. I mean, I was married, I had a family, I had a professional career, et cetera, et cetera. But there was still just this kind of subjective experience of myself that was not successful. And so I would continue, and in the context of the rest of my life, say a job search or something like this, these stories would continue and continue and all this kind of thing. And finally, the distance got so great one day. It was in March of 2005. I don't remember the exact day. And I just stopped, and I began crying. Tears began flowing. I mean, it sounds like such a dramatic experience, and I suppose externally it maybe looked as if it was, but internally there was nothing except pure, sweet relief. And what happened essentially, during that period, I think it lasted about an hour, and I was just exhausting this last barrier of emotion within myself. And again, sounds very dramatic, but over time I've come to see, yes, that's exactly what happened. After that hour or so of emotional release, certainly there have been unwindings and new understandings, because the one thing that liberation does give a person is the ability to look at themselves absolutely critically and ruthlessly in a way that they were never able to before. Because there is no more sort of personal attribution, you know, and all this kind of stories and framework and all that. There just happens to be, you know, where many parts of me used to be, if I go ahead and investigate them, where I end up is just in pure undifferentiated silence. It's a very impersonal sort of space.
Well, let's take a few steps back and kind of
go
into a little bit more detail on what you said. Because on the one hand, you were saying that for years and years, you were, you know, had this habit of trying to sort of make yourself look good, at least in your own eyes, and using...
Make up a story that made sense. A dynamic story that makes sense.
So you were kind of living in your stories, you could say.
Oh, big time.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people do this. It's not like something that you were exclusively prone to. And probably most people do it unconsciously. You were going through this thing. You were living in your stories. You were meditating regularly. You were having good spiritual experiences. But then all of a sudden you brought us to the point where you had this breakdown or breakthrough, and you began crying, and then you began using the word liberated. Was that your moment of liberation?
Absolutely.
So this whole purging or this whole catharsis where you started crying and everything, that was a major breakthrough for you.
Huge. I would equate it on the same level as being physically born into the world. Felt no, you know, if I contrast those, now let's see, so that was 2005, so I was 50 years old, almost 51. If I contrasted those previous 50 years to the last five, that's how great the difference has been. Hmm. It's been just completely night and day.
Was there anything in particular that triggered this breakthrough, or do you feel like it was just the ready time for the chick to hatch out of its egg, and it just sort of happened at a certain time?
There was an event in my daily life. I had been trying to get this one particular job, mm-hmm. and I didn't get it. Uh-huh. And that was sort of the catalyst that led to it. But, you know, it's kind of like, what did somebody was talking about, somebody saying, you know, bus exhaust could cause, or
right.
could serve as the same catalyst.
Yeah, Marcy said that, you know, the stink of a rotten bus could be the trigger for enlightenment if the time is right.
And, you know, anything that probably has sufficient contrast can really be the trigger. But really what was happening, I think, as I've reflected on this, is that the meditation, continuing to transcend twice a day, was really sabotaging all of those stories that I had going. So, you know, eventually the stories grew so complex and so rigid, and the reality was so different, that something had to give, and something gave.
Wow, very cool. So after this breakthrough, you say mm-hmm. you felt like a completely different person. It's interesting you use the metaphor of it's like being born or something, because obviously that's a very
sure.
common phrase that the Christians use, being born,
exactly.
born again.
Sure. Right, born again,
yeah.
exactly.
So you were born again.
More or less, yeah.
Metaphor.
Yeah, or, you know, I would say maybe, you know, it was sort of like I was in a cage of my own making, and then one day I opened the door. I mean, all of this stuff sounds trite to some degree, because, I mean, I've read spiritual books and heard about people talk about this stuff, and there really doesn't seem to be any fresh way to say it. So that's, you know, but it was very much a liberation. It was like, okay, here I am. I felt at the same time completely responsible for myself, and at the same time completely free. So both of those things at the same time.
Well, you know, in a way there's no fresh way to say it, because everyone's referring to the same thing. But on the other hand, I find that everyone who expresses it is saying it afresh, because they're saying it in their own words. And,
sure.
you know, I think everyone has equal authority to tell the story of that experience.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
And
well, I was just going to say, I wasn't questioning so much my ability to speak about it, but more, as we were talking about earlier, I do have sort of an artistic sensitivity or an artistic awareness. And so whenever I read something or write something or do something or paint or put together music, I do like it to be expressed in a way that is not boring, you know, or mundane. Because I think when things are expressed in that way, people just don't hear them, you know.
Right.
You could read, if somebody were to just sit here and say over and over again, you know, I'm enlightened, or talk about maybe 10 attributes of enlightenment, and it just starts to sound, you know, rehearsed or dead or something.
Yeah.
So I always
yeah.
try to put things in a fresh way.
That's good. So this is like 2005, about 5 years ago, you had this breakthrough. Let's kind of delve into the characteristics of the breakthrough. For instance, would you say that the primary characteristic of it was a cessation of your tendency to create stories to kind of make your ego feel good? Or was that just, in retrospect, was that a minor aspect of it, and there were much more kind of alluring aspects of it that came about?
That's a good question. So initially what I noticed, it was like I had been living under a airport flight path and all the flights had suddenly stopped. So there was a huge subjective experience of all of the mental chatter that had been in my head. And now that was gone for the most part.
Kind of like
now, of course, you know,
living near Heathrow as we speak.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The thing is, that has occurred to me lately is, well, maybe I got rid of 90%, but my mind's still a chattering monkey. It's just that it doesn't seem like it is anymore. You know, everything's relative. So, I mean, that may well be the case. But subjectively, huge amount of silence in my mind, huge amount of acceptance in my heart, Okay, let's carry the analogy a little further. If I was living under the flight path, but there was somebody in the neighborhood that was always playing the most beautiful music, but I could never hear it because the planes were always overhead. Mm. So the planes stop, and I begin to be able to concentrate and focus on things that I was not able to before. And so the growth that I've been able to experience psychologically in the last 5 years has just been huge, because there's really been no barrier to examining anything that I want to, you know, past, present, or future.
Cool. Well, I definitely want to get into that. I just want to make the brief comment that it seems to me that minds will be mine. As long as we're a human being, we have one, and it's still going to do its thing.
Right.
But, you know, what you described beautifully is that the emphasis shift or the orientation shifted from one in which, you know, the mind and its idiosyncrasies was predominant into one in which it took a back seat. And, you know, it's still doing its function, and it's a necessary function, but it was no longer predominantly running the show. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. You know, I've heard the phrase sort of assumes its rightful role, and I think that's very apt with all subjective aspects of ourselves, whether it's input from our senses or the mind or even the ego. I'm one of those that believes it doesn't go away, it just attains its rightful place.
Yeah.
You know?
No, that's, and so everything. Good, actually, you know, because, I mean, there's so many different faculties like that which usurp, you know, their. The role that really doesn't belong to them, which really mucks things up, you know? And when everything is kind of balanced and in its place, then life flows so much more smoothly.
Absolutely. Yeah, no question about that. Okay, so maybe it sounds like a TM lecture, you know, sort of 35 years later, but I do find that I have the ability to kind of keep more plates spinning in the air, and I do well, and I enjoy it, and it really doesn't matter what's going on or where I'm headed. None of that stuff is all that important anymore. So, yeah, the cessation of the stories and having them replaced with clearly looking at reality is just, yeah, it's huge.
Yeah, and you do seem to have a fair amount going on. You've got a fairly demanding job, and you compose a lot of music, and you're married or in a relationship, and,
sure,
you know, life is busy, but everything is well and wisely put, I take.
It is. It is. I'll just say that because of the economy, I am not working full-time, but when I am, absolutely, I maintain my job. I have a house. I've done a lot of work in the house and on the house and the music, and my daughter's 20.
So let's get into this stuff that you were mentioning a minute ago where, you know, after this shift,
sure,
you kind of freed up your mental resources to begin to look at things and explore things and experience things which weren't available to you before that.
Okay. Well, you know, I think one thing that, again, I'm just going to go back to my past a little bit. It was somewhat unusual. You know, a lot of people will move a few times in their life, maybe within the same country, whatever. The experience of moving from country to country to country, there was all that normal kind of family dynamics, you know, who I'm getting along with, who I'm not, what I'm learning, what I'm not, what I'm doing well at and what I'm not. On this very rapidly moving foundation of, you know, moving from country to country to country. So I think what that did was inhibited me in some ways from actually going back and resolving some events from my past that may have been traumatic or whatever. And the way that I used to resolve them, not really, but the way that I would make up a story about them was just, you know, how bad and horrible these people were and how wonderful I was, and maybe when they got to be as wonderful as I was, they wouldn't do those things anymore, or something, you know.
Right.
It almost seems like fiction now, but that's certainly the process that was going on. Whereas now, it's a matter of just looking at things, understanding first and foremost that anything that is going on, what I'm seeing, what I'm doing, what I'm experiencing, what I'm thinking, all of that stuff is just starting with me. There's nothing artificial about it, or responsibility to be put anywhere else except whatever my experience may be, you know, good, bad, or indifferent.
So are you saying you tend now to take responsibility for everything that happens in your life as opposed to blaming others for any of it? Or would you say that there's a kind of a balance where, you know, some people are at fault for certain things and you are at fault to a certain extent or whatever? Or maybe I'm missing the point altogether.
Well, you know, it's kind of like like that. So, yeah, there is complete responsibility. I would say that the difference there is that, yes, I'm still operating in a world where I can look at a table. I know it's made of atoms. I know I'm made of atoms, but I also know I'm not a table. I mean, relatively speaking.
Right.
So there is that going on. Taking that a step further, you know, if something happens, say, politically or whatever, I guess maybe on the national scene, I do tend to comment on that. You know, I'll say, oh, you know, that person's a jerk or whatever, you know. But I recognize, it used to be, I didn't recognize that it was me saying that, that it was me thinking that, that it was me ultimately taking responsibility for that. It used to be that it was that, but it was said more as a, say somebody's a jerk or whatever, as a condemnation of them. And not only a condemnation, but an unforgivable condemnation. In other words, I could never get right with them because I didn't know who I was. You know, there was no reference point. And so the only way that I could get right with somebody else was to feel better than they were.
So are you saying, for instance, that, well, taking politics as an example, when you had a political opinion, were you kind of absolutist about it, you know, that this is the truth and everybody else who doesn't see it this way is incorrect and I happen to have the correct perspective?
Yeah.
And now you kind of, you know, have the realization that perhaps every perspective has its own significance, that we're all just, you know, blind men.
It's own validity.
We're each a blind man feeling a part of the elephant, and we don't necessarily have, you know, all perspectives. We're just one human being with our own.
Exactly.
Which makes
you, there's
non-fundamentalist, whereas perhaps you were in the past to a certain extent.
Oh, I would say definitely, yeah. In fact, that's a good word to use, Rick, for the way I used to think. Extremely fundamentalist. And then, of course, you know, associated with the TM movement, I never got into it to the extent that I saw some of the people in that organization do. In fact, that's why I ultimately decided not to join it in a formal way, because as lost as I was, I could see that this whole boundaries and rationalization thing could go so far that you could just become, you know, completely lost in it.
Huh.
And even though I needed it as sort of a coping mechanism during all those years, or felt that I did, I was still miserable because I could never reach a point of arrogance and blindness to the point where I actually felt that I was better than everybody else was.
Yes. Would you say that the foundation of this newfound objectivity is that, you know, you've tapped into or realized something which is beyond boundaries, which is beyond individual perspectives?
Well, so what happened, the way, and again, as a process of reflection, what I realized is the more that I uncovered these parts of myself, you know, so I sort of reached that state of liberation, of being born, of nakedness, whatever you want to call it. And having been exposed to that state and realizing, oh, I don't exist any more than everything else doesn't exist, I don't know, the whole perspective did change, did completely change. It then became an experience where all of that universality and all that kind of stuff, I found that it infused everything and does infuse everything. So then that seriously affected my ability to judge others and judge other things. Because if you're going around saying, oh, that person sucks and that person sucks, with a sort of that fundamental, absolute type of feeling, then it's almost like you're breaking that contract of universality. It's like there's no way, if that person sucks and I'm better than they are, that they can be as universal as I am, right?
Let's talk about universality a little bit, because we kind of glossed over it, and some people might not know what we mean by universality.
Okay.
I think what you're suggesting is that something dawned in your experience which was of a universal nature, which you hadn't been aware of before that, and because you became aware of it, it shifted your whole orientation to life, your whole perspective on people, even your behavior shifted because there was this new universal kind of foundation from which you were operating. So perhaps you could elaborate on that and, you know, see whether you concur with what I just said or would like to expand upon it.
Yeah, so when I used to meditate, you know, I'd reach that level of silence or whatever, and then or I'm assuming I did, and then I'd come out into activity, or I'd find that silence within myself other ways, you know, like go for a 10-mile run or something in the mountains and isolate myself as much as possible. I could start to, you know, get away from some of that limited nature and start to feel somewhat more expanded. But I'd say really the universal thing that I can talk about mentally is much more an expression of the heart just bursting open. You know, it reaches a point where it doesn't want to feel restricted anymore. It decides that it has lost its fear to feel restricted, or I don't know, that's kind of a chicken or the egg thing, right? Essentially, I could say that I feel more universal. Now, how that translates into my ordinary life is I am just calmer. I have much better relationships with people. I don't tend to take things absolutely like we were talking about. And I find things like my music is a good example, where I was very self-conscious of exposing parts of myself. I remember I went through another transformation, not quite as radical, but when I took the Siddhis course, which, you know, doing a series of sutras to enliven the subtle nature of the senses, I, after that course, I realized I could dance by myself, you know, like in a club and stuff, because I always liked to dance, I always enjoyed music, but I was so self-conscious, so inhibited from all of these things. And now, you know, I mean, I tend to be, as my personality, still somewhat introspective, but it's not combined with that kind of fear and that fear of being exposed and that fear of being found out and probably that ultimate fear of being laughed at or something, you know. And so there are aspects to my life, and I would say my music is probably a clear example of that, where, you know, that fear just isn't there anymore, and there's much more an ability and a willingness to take advantage of whatever it is that life brings me.
Are you saying that Jim Flanagan of Santa Clara, California has become universal, or are you saying that there's something of a truly universal nature that Jim Flanagan has tapped into that has kind of become part of the whole spectrum of his life? Can you understand the difference?
Yeah, kind of. You know, universal is a pretty big word. Mm-hmm. And so I would hesitate to say that I've become universal. I can't find any boundaries within myself. Uh-huh. But again, universal is a big word, right? And so I would say that the way that has manifested for me in my life is I can just undertake anything, and I think about anything I want, and I look at anything any way that I want, and there's just... It's freedom is really the way I'd characterize it, is freedom versus that word. I don't know, that word universal, it's kind of loaded. It's like I have no idea what the end of the universe looks like, or, you know, whether there's one of them out there or billions of them out there or two of them out there or three and a half. I mean, you know, I have no clue.
Well, the reason I pursued that line of questioning is that, you know, I don't think most people think of themselves as, most people in the world, as having a universal sort of dimension to their existence.
Sure.
They primarily right. think of themselves in terms of, you know, concrete, definable attributes, such as their appearance, right. their age, their socioeconomic status, their gender, you know, things like that. And to me, the word universal denotes something that transcends all those things, kind of like a wave on the ocean is individual, and the entire ocean is universal. And we, you know, you and I
right.
and 7 billion other people on the planet are all like individual waves, but underlying all these waves is something universal. And someone who is having the kind of experience that you've been describing, to my way of thinking, has become aware of their oceanhood, so to speak, while remaining a wave. And that gives the wave much greater confidence. As Maharishi used to say, you know, in a small pond, a wave can't rise up very high. It'll just stir up the mud at the bottom. But in an ocean, right. you know, it can become a huge tidal
right.
wave, one of those 50-foot surfing waves in Hawaii.
And I suppose, sure. I mean, if I'm looking at myself, if I was to build a duality in my mind and construct a model where I was very, very small, say of molecular size or something, and I'm comparing myself to something like a galaxy, yeah, I don't really see any difference. So I guess in that way I could say, yes, I have that sort of universal nature or so on. But again, you know, universe is such a big word. Oh, and now I wanted to mention, too, about your example where you say there's 7 billion people and they all have a very limited perspective, but if we can find sort of the common nature of that awareness that they may or may not be aware of, it's more sort of oceanic. And I suppose if I step myself through it like that, there's nothing you say that I would disagree with. Although there's a characteristic to whatever this state is, call it liberation or whatever, that is absolutely 100% normal and therefore very mundane. Maybe at first, in fact, I know at first there was this huge kind of feeling of liberation and relief and, you know, blah, 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 and no more stories and all this kind of thing. Whereas now, I would be hard-pressed to associate any such characteristic to myself as universal or even liberated or any of that. I mean, I'm so deeply immersed in my life now and have so many rewarding experiences in my heart and in terms of the senses and just the way I go about living now that it's very difficult to say I am someplace that is in any remote way sort of special or universal or anything like that. So there is quite a difference between stair-stepping myself through a series of assumptions and recognizing my universality and then actually seeing that I live it. I mean, I just think that I live a normal life.
Yeah. Well, I'd say you do, you know, from what you described of it. And in fact, you know, to quote Maharishi again, he always used to refer to enlightenment as normal life.
Yeah.
Yes, he used to say that, you know, until we have begun to live in that state, some very more disparaging adjectives to refer to states in which we hadn't.
But and it is absolutely true, yeah. There is definitely a huge contrast, no question about it. And I do feel that the previous living was, yeah, just very pinched, very pinched.
Yeah.
It was like trying to stuff all of that. And even now, I still feel that way sometimes, you know. I still feel that way. I still feel like, well, gosh, there's still so much more to explore and to do and, you know, this and that. And then, you know, that's balanced out against feeling so much better all the time that if I just want to sit on my ass for 3 days and do nothing, I'll do that.
Yeah.
Well, not that I do, but I...
you could if you wanted.
Theoretically.
Well, I mean, if you calculated all the time you spent meditating since you're 21 years old, it's probably you've been sitting on your ass for a lot more than a few days, but... added it all up. But I mean, what you're talking about here, you know, points out an interesting thing, I think, which is that human beings have a tendency to adapt to whatever, you know. I mean, Eskimos are adapted to living in the Arctic, and, you know, people who live in deserts are adapted to that, and we just sort of adjust. We're like chameleons in a sense. We adjust to our environment. And after a certain amount of time, it becomes normal, and we don't think twice about it. And I've heard people say, wow, I had this flashy experience on this meditation course I was on, and I sure would love to be able to have that flashy experience all the time. But to my understanding, we're not constituted to have a flashy experience all the time. An experience which might, you know, initially seem flashy becomes commonplace once we become accustomed to it.
You know, that's absolutely right. I was thinking back, somebody was talking about, I think it was on the Buddha at the Gas Pump Forum, about these states, higher states of consciousness that Maharishi used to talk about, cosmic consciousness, as I say, being the witnessing of the subjective of the objective, and then God consciousness being subtle experiences of the senses. Right, of perception. And so first off, this CC thing, which I've never been much into, because whenever I experienced it, like on courses and stuff, it always felt really dirty, you know? I don't know how else to put it, but the witnessing had kind of this grainy sort of polluted quality to it, you know?
Well, that was really cosmic consciousness, as Maharishi defined
it? Well, it wasn't.
Or something.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely felt that kind of... I mean, I understand that dynamic, and I was having it. But anyway, it was never too much into it. But more importantly, this kind of thing with the you know, you take the cities course, and you learn how to refine your senses, and at first that was a very flashy thing. Now I use it in terms of sometimes my wife will get into a situation, she's a technical writer, she'll go through a tremendous amount of concentration and really just kind of rack up her shoulders or something like that. Or there's been even more serious injuries that both she and I have suffered. And the thing that I found very interesting was that going back to the cities, this ability to work with fields of energy and all this kind of thing, another thing that I be very fascinated with and first saw them on a course was seeing angels, you know, just kind of these people with wings or beings with wings. And it seemed very special and all that kind of thing. What I find now is that because I don't live in my head, because I'm not rationalizing everything and building up walls between me and everything else, everyday experience is equally as rich as those peak, even more so than those peak experiences used to be. So when I go to the kitchen in the morning and I open the refrigerator and I take out that orange juice and I decide what size glass I want, pour it in, and I pour it in and I watch the orange liquid stream going into the glass and filling it up, and I know just where it's going to stop, that to me is a cosmic experience. That's, and I'm being absolutely serious. I mean, it is so rich and wonderful and amazing, and I can almost see the molecules of orange juice, and so everything is like that now.
Nice.
These kind of peak experiences, yeah, you know, these peak experiences, the kind of refinement of the senses and all this kind of thing, I can turn that on and off at will, but I don't really choose to anymore. Because it's like, eh. You know, the other day, I think I was sitting with my wife, we were having a glass of wine or something, and I said, I was talking about celestial beings or something, and I said, yeah, and you know, there's one standing right there. Mm-hmm. And she says, what? And I, even though I noticed it and I was able to mention it to her, it meant more than, oh, and you know, I locked my keys in the car the other day.
Huh. Yeah.
So that's kind of the sameness that everything takes on. And there isn't sort of, oh, this is wonderful and that sucks. You know, even the sucky stuff is pretty cool.
Well, that kind of corroborates what I was saying, that we become accustomed to things. You know, and at first, seeing an angel would be a pretty amazing thing. I mean, you know, I don't know how many people in the world have seen angels, and you know, most people deny that they even exist. But if you saw them every day, after a while, it would be, all right, what's next, you know?
Exactly. They perform a specific purpose, just like turning on the light or, yeah, walking outside.
Now, having said that, since you've tantalized us with mentions of angels and celestial beings, would you feel inclined,
okay,
you feel inclined to elaborate a little bit on what exactly you perceive or have perceived? And
so first, when I was doing the kind of the meditation, sort of hitting the silence, come back up in activity, do that twice a day, and then started doing these Siddhis techniques, which I don't do anymore. For one thing, they take too long, and they just take too long. It's kind of like too much trouble. No, sorry, you know.
This thing you're referring to is, I've mentioned this on previous shows because people have brought it up, but it's a specific set of techniques that are taught in the Transcendental Meditation Movement as a sort of an advanced stage of practice. And so many of us learn that and practice it for a number of years, and many people still do. So anyway, that's what you're referring to. Go ahead.
Exactly. And what those techniques do is they begin to fuse that silence that we experience in meditation with the activity that we experience when we're out of meditation, and then the two kind of fuse together. And so I remember I was on a course in Washington, D.C. in 19...
I was there.
God, I don't know. 80... Oh, were you?
Summertime.
Oh, okay.
Really hot.
Yeah, and there was that hotel. Remember the hotel on 11th Street?
1111 H Street, right?
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it might not have been the same course, but anyway, go ahead.
So we were there, and we were doing all this stuff, and I remember seeing these kind of, they looked like a time and exposure of somebody moving a light trail. And that's the best way I can explain them. And they were sort of golden colored, and it was the first time that I think I was having sort of celestial experiences. And I think the dirty aspect that I was talking about before, Rick, was because my heart in some way wasn't ready for this, and my nervous system overall wasn't ready to kind of sustain this type of experience.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so it was just kind of, I don't know, it always seemed to have a lot of emotion associated with it and things like this. But over time, what I began to see was certain of my senses, particularly my sense of sight. I've always been a visual artist, always had very good vision, and I found that if I mentally shifted the frequency of my sight, that all sorts of things started appearing. And I would notice this particularly around, and I don't know in response to what? I believe there's something that goes on emotionally first. Maybe there's some perception of divine love in the heart. I don't know. But in any case, when I shifted my seeing, when I was at a hospital not too many years ago, I was amazed. I mean, the place was covered in angels, and they are. I mean, they're just everywhere. You know, I'm not really sure what they're doing and stuff. Like I say, I tend not to get too involved with stuff like that because, you know, here I am in the world where most people don't see them. So, you know, to get totally involved in all that is a distraction. But I've seen them. You know, I used to read my daughter bedtime stories, and frequently they would appear in a different form above me. And one time when I felt particularly ill, I laid down and I actually felt an angel enfold me in his wings. It was, you know, the Archangel Michael.
How do you know it was him?
I don't know. It just the name came into my head.
So he was helping to heal you from your sickness?
Exactly. I was just lying there, and he kind of, it gave me a space for my ill energy. You know, sickness is often caused by, it's an excess of energy in the body. It'll create whatever, the ill part of the body will be very dense, and it will take on certain color characteristics. And I've noticed this, in fact, I have a slightly stretched ankle ligament. And so I can see that anytime I want, and I can tell, you know, what stage it is at in terms of the healing by the color of energy that it gives off.
Sort of like an aura?
It's kind of like that. You know, like I always used to see those pictures of auras, and it would be kind of like a band of color surrounding the object. Mm-hmm. And what I actually do is I go in and I look at, like, the muscle fibers and stuff. Mm-hmm. And just like if you take your hand and you make a fist out of it, you'll notice the area around your knuckles turns white.
Right.
And that's exactly what happens to an injured part of the body, is the blood stays away because it's been injured. It's kind of still in, I don't know, shock or freak out mode or something like that. And then what happens is, and there are a couple of colors associated with that. One is green, which is maybe associated with the lymphatic system or something, but when an area begins to heal, it'll turn green. It's not a very pleasant color of green, but that is certainly preferable to what it does before that is the energy is black, and it is so dense and condensed, and it doesn't want to move. You know, when you get hurt, you just sort of freeze up,
yeah.
And that's kind of what the energy does, and so it stays very, very, very concentrated in that black, and then it turns that kind of green, and then I can start to see blood flow start to enter the area and so on, and it eventually heals as it normally does. But those are just some of the experiences that I've had for an awfully long time, and like I say, in the last 5 years are just become integrated into my life. It's not, is it special or is it this or that? I don't talk about them. I just use them like you would anything else.
Yeah, just spontaneously when it's of value to use.
Exactly.
Yeah. And,
exactly.
Do you find that you can not only kind of perceive this subtle stuff and also like perceive inside your body in different ways, but you can do so either with a telescopic view or a microscopic view? You can kind of get into real tiny or really huge levels of perception.
Yeah, you know, I haven't done the huge levels of perception.
Like if you wanted to step out and see the whole Milky Way galaxy or something like that, is that accessible to you? Or
It is, but it's not necessarily the way that I would see it from Earth. Like if I want to look at something galactically or whatever,
yeah.
It's more that I just all of a sudden will manifest consciousness in some area of it and be traveling through it. You know, and it's usually of fairly short duration. Like I can boost my frequency, but it does take energy, and so I don't tend to do it for long periods of time.
Mm.
And it's the same with working inside people's body and stuff. Like I said, it's excess energy there, and doing is removing it, and that also takes some effort.
Huh.
It's an interesting thing with this body energy stuff. I remember particularly with my wife, she'll have, particularly if she was feeling some great emotional upset and manifests itself in color and so on, and I can pull that energy then through the palm of my hand. If you look at the palm of your hand, you may notice that the very center of it is lighter than the surrounding part. And I think this is because it's a channel that can be utilized. And so it's fairly easy to be touching somebody, and then you pull their excess energy out of them into your solar plexus. There you kind of just turn it into a neutral energy and it dissipates.
Huh.
You know, that's it. I guess the other thing I wanted to mention about that is taking energy out is can be done in a fairly easy way and so on. You can also put energy back in, but you just have to be super careful. If you can imagine, say, like a box full of styrofoam pellets, and the box is full, and you take a bunch more styrofoam pellets, and you try to cram them into the box, it's going to create a lot of friction and displacement and all that kind of stuff. So whenever you're putting energy into an entity, you just have to do it very easily, and just be very aware of the quality of the energy. Huh. But we're way off track.
This is kind of interesting stuff. In fact, I was sort of hoping that one of my guests would talk more about this kind of thing. It's in the TM, this kind of thing is often considered to be a distraction. But
right.
You know, the way you're presenting it, I think, is very practical. It's sort of like you're not on some big trip of what you can do or see. You're just saying it's very matter of fact, it's normal, it's ordinary, and it's stuff that I didn't really ask for, but that I just found myself able to see or to do. And I don't use it all the time, but sometimes it's useful. Yeah?
Exactly. That's just it.
You know, I think that a lot of times this stuff is de-emphasized in spiritual circles because it could become a distraction if a person's primary motivation becomes to, you know, to be able to see and do this sort of thing. They're kind of missing the point. There's something larger than this. These are just kind of symptoms. The analogy Maharshi used to use was that, you know, if you have a territory, maybe there is a gold mine and a copper mine and a silver mine and a diamond mine and so on around in the territory. You can get all, you could get all distracted chasing after and trying to capture each one of these little mines.
Right.
But if you were to just capture the fort, which is at the center of the territory and commands the whole thing, all the mines will be anyway. So go for the fort. So what you're saying is that you've pretty much, you know, managed to capture the fort, and that after having done so, you found that you were able to explore some of these mines.
Exactly. That's precisely it. You know, before, when I would do the cities program and stuff, one of the reasons that I stopped was that the experiences I would have, say, of looking into the body or transforming myself into light or something like that, it was just too overwhelming an experience. It's like, no, wait a minute, what happened to that little nasty dude that makes up stories about everybody? You know, I need him back, and I need him back now. So there was kind of that thing going on, whereas now, it's like, and in fact, I don't openly talk about this stuff typically. Well, I guess I do now because I just have. But it's one of those things that it's so everyday. You know, I think the thing that Maharishi was cautioning against was when I was talking about my prior experience where life was kind of dry and I lived it in my head and I knew everything about everything about everything because I decided that I did. Then those kind of peak experiences appeared to be peak experiences because they made me feel alive. They had my senses going. My heart was engaged. You know, it wasn't just all mental, sort of through the desert. And since having that experience of inspiration or whatever, where something like pouring a glass of orange juice in the morning can be very rewarding and sort of cosmic experience, then these types of things, sort of the diamond mines and all that kind of stuff, it's like, who cares, you know? I mean, even things like there were people discussing sort of unity and all this kind of stuff. No disrespect to them, but I could not care less. And to me, instead, these deities, they take on their rightful place in a very innocent way.
What deities? You're referring to deities all of a sudden.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I suppose I am. Well, you know, we were on angels and next logical step. But yeah, you know, like sometimes if I'll think about any of these kind of, you know, the big names, you know, the top 20 or something, you know, sort of there's Jesus and there's Krishna and there's Buddha and there's
Shiva and
Vishnu
and all that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. Shiva, all those fellows.
And presumably ones that go by other names, you know, as referred to in other cultures, South American cultures, Native American cultures. So what's the deal with them?
The other thing that I've really changed my perspective on is it used to be, you know, sort of like humanity down here, deities up there. I don't know. There was some sort of bizarre value system that I had picked up somewhere along the way where I saw this hierarchy. And that, too, has very much gone by the wayside. Now, the other thing that appears to be a contradiction to that is if I were just to say the word of, say, Jesus or Shiva or something like that, just say it silently, you know, there's a distinct vibration, there's a distinct color, and oftentimes there's a distinct form associated with those names, which is far more real than all of the kind of, I won't say it's far more real than the way I was able to experience any of that. Before it was just, it was a name, I kind of knew it was big.
Right.
But that's kind of the farthest I could get. Now, if I want to speak to Vishnu, I want to speak to Krishna, I want to speak to anybody, I just speak to them, and it's a lively, dynamic relationship.
Huh. So it's not just a matter of saying their name and evoking some feeling or some energy or some image. You're saying that you actually sometimes engage in conversation?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, the thing is, it's all sort of a transmission of energy, so I may have thoughts that are actually could be written down, and then other times it's more, you know, kind of a feeling. But the point being that all of the sort of deities or entities have become just as real as anything else. You know, it's sort of like anything that I focus on or want to know more about, it's merely by just kind of putting the attention there, that thing just radiates out from that, becomes a very full experience. Uh-huh. And there are certain things then, as a result, actually, Angela was talking about this on the forum recently, and I think you had interviewed her, Angela Mailander.
Right.
And she was talking about how the organization of the universe comes from the universe itself. It's not from our interpretation of that. And this is an experience I've had certainly all my life, where I've just approached when I wasn't into that, all making up stories and all this kind of thing, but even to some extent, where I would just approach life in an innocent way, and the way that it ends up looking to us or appearing to us or the way we experience it is often very different from the way that somebody may have written about this experience. There's sort of a corruption that occurs when people talk about these things for a long time, and also way which knowledge gets hidden. And I'll give you a specific example. We've heard this term for years about approach the feet of the master, right? I've heard it. It's all about, oh yeah, you surrender at their feet and all this kind of jazz. You know, it's sort of the personification of humility. I had a very interesting experience years ago where I began to feel closer and closer to Rishi's teacher, this fellow Brahmananda Saraswati Gurudev. And I remember I was out one day, I was going for a run and all this kind of thing, and then all of a sudden I saw Gurudev, but I didn't see Gurudev, I saw his foot. And I saw his foot at about eye level. And all of a sudden I realized, oh, approach the feet of the master. Okay, so there's no other way to do it. I've clarified that experience, and at least for me, I understand now, oh, okay, so you begin to see that stuff, that's where you start out, is at the feet. And you have to. I mean, it kind of all makes sense. It's kind of like, oh, yeah, so then the surrender is actually real, and it does have to do with the feet, and that's where you end up, and you're lower than they are. Each of these images has so much knowledge better than the actual experience. And then that's where these expressions come from.
Some people might find this odd, but you're in your running shoes and your little running shorts, and you're running down a trail, and all of a sudden you see this foot, and you know that it's Gurudev, Maharshi's master. I'm not disputing that. I mean, I believe you, but I think some people might find a comical depiction.
Exactly. So the thing is, there was background to that, and that is, so I first experienced Gurudev, seeing him kind of in sort of the third eye area, so sort of here, but kind of projected outward, maybe, about a foot. And I would see his head and shoulders, and I saw that for years and years and years and years and years. And then I would see his full form and so on. But this approaching the feet of the master was such a distinct experience because of its clarity. I mean, I could see the ridges on the kind of toe prints, and I could see each thread making up these wonderful patterns on the hem of his garment. And so it was a very, very clear experience.
Now, thinking of one of the skeptics on Fairfield Life Chat Group who would probably respond to this and say, you know, fine, you have vivid powers of visualization. You know, you're an artist.
Of imagination.
Yeah, you're an artist, and you're a very visual person, and you're able to conjure up sort of, you know, images
sure.
in your mind, which are nothing
right.
more than that, you know, images in your mind.
Right.
So, exactly. You know, what can you say? What would you say to such a person? Not that you would necessarily want to convince them, because it's your own experience and it's your own business, and you don't really have to convince anybody of anything. But you know, what might you say to just sort of convey to listeners the sense of the genuineness and the reality of this, as opposed to it being some sort of, you know, just imagery in your own head?
Gosh, I don't know what I would say to them. So at the time, because I think you were alluding earlier to my sort of days on Fairfield Live when I had this liberation and stuff, it was so obvious to me. It was as if one day I walked out onto my deck in the back and I could see the Pacific Ocean there. And then I called somebody, say in Washington, D.C., and I'd say, hey, guess what? You know, I can see the Pacific Ocean off my deck. Mm-hmm. I don't know. How would you convince somebody that you could actually see that? I don't know. I know that when I had first experienced this feeling of liberation, there was almost a self-righteousness in me, because the experience had such integrity that it was kind of like, how can you possibly doubt this? I would never tell you a lie. And for what reason would I tell you a lie?
Been a meditator myself for 40-odd years. I've known people who've...
maybe made up stories.
Yeah, or they've sort of like been almost desperate to be the king of the hill, so to speak, and sort of any experience that, you know, that you hear in some book or that Maharishi happened to mention, hey, I've got that, and everybody gather around and I'll tell you about it, you know. So there was definitely, and if you doubted it or expressed any skepticism, there was this reaction like, wait a minute now, you've got to believe me, because there's one guy in particular that made quite a stir in the TM movement that I'm thinking of right now that ended up, you know, going off on some tangent. But there is this sort of thing, and I don't know why I'm getting into this tack, because I don't believe this applies to you at all, but there is this sort of thing we referred to earlier as a kind of a spiritual egotism, where you use spiritual experiences as a way of drawing attention to yourself. You don't really talk about this stuff. You're just talking about it to me now because we're having this interview. Perhaps it's useful to just mention this, because I want to remind people of the context and, you know, dispel any notion that a viewer might have that you're just kind of tooting your horn here. You know, I'm drawing this stuff out of you because I think it's interesting and I think people will find it interesting.
Sure.
But people can take it or leave it. If they don't believe it, then fine. No big deal.
There is no big deal, and the other thing is, having been on the other side of the fence, where the ego is going to try to achieve primacy in any interaction that it has, I can see very much how somebody, you know, talking about a big flashy experience or whatever, the experience that I used to have was that I felt very small, my experiences were often very dry, I'd often try to recreate, you know, sort of a peak experience or whatever, any way that I could. That's natural. I mean, that's completely natural, I think. If somebody is just sort of living in that duality and they are that, you know, I've often likened the way that the ego operates in that state as being a mummy. You know, it's like you've wrapped yourself up with all the bandages, and on the bandages are written all the stories, and you're constantly rewrapping yourself and having to constantly dynamically adjust to the world so that you can continue to, I don't know, justify your existence, I guess. And now, if somebody were to come up and ask me out of interest, you know, like we're having this conversation, I'm happy to talk about it, but if they came up and challenged me, I wouldn't have anything to say to them. I'd probably, you know, look down at their backpack and ask them where they got it.
And I would suggest that perhaps the reason you wouldn't have anything to say to them is that you really don't have anything to prove here. I mean, it's not like it's going to add a feather to your cap if somebody recognizes you as having these experiences.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, so what?
Exactly. I think the point is not so much these experiences, which may lay a few inches outside of common experience, but the real joy and the real benefit to liberation is being able to have, like I say, any kind of experience. It's wonderful,
like,
and it's rich and great. Like pouring the orange juice or having a headache. Sometimes, you know, I don't get headaches that often, but sometimes I'll just have a bad one. I don't know, maybe drank too much the night before or whatever. And it's just fascinating to me to watch that go on in my mind, in my brain, in my physiology, and watch it unwind and fix itself, and watch all the muscles contract, and how the pain then gets sent, you know, through nerve pathways. I mean, it sounds bizarre, but it's actually very nice, very, very rich way to look.
It's interesting you mentioned drinking, because most people would think that someone who's this far along on a spiritual path, seeing angels and stuff, wouldn't be interested in drinking. Although, you know, I guess Jesus.
Or although maybe
Jesus
I'm
had
seeing
a fair
them.
Share of wine, so what the heck.
Right, right. One of the things that Maharishi really brought out, and I really liked about his technique from the very early days, was that even though I did go on and get involved with kind of the movement and get more into, you know, sort of the mumbo jumbo, the thing I really liked about it for so many years was I've always been a fairly independent person, and I've always wanted to do what I want to do, you know, call it selfish or call it, you know, directed. But that's just the way I've always been. And so when I learned TM and all this, I saw the charts kind of like, oh, yeah, you know, clean living, blah, blah, blah. And I tried to be a vegetarian, you know, very diligently. But, God, I'll tell you, you know, like last night, good example. We were sitting there watching a movie. We had finished the movie. We were wondering what else to do. And I'm really hungry. I'd made some shrimp curry earlier. I had it, but, you know, like Chinese food, didn't really do the trick. And so we went out and did a little bit of shopping, and then I said, you know, I really have to go to McDonald's, you know. And to their credit, I mean, they're probably the best fast food chain out there in terms of just having fresh food, and it tastes reasonably good. So I went there, and I got a quarter pounder with cheese and a large fries and a Coke, you know. And it was awesome. I mean, it just hit. You know, I think also some people have said, you know, you better get rid of your bad habits before liberation, because afterwards you're not going to give a damn. Yeah. And that's entirely true. You know, it really is. So I probably don't treat my body as, you know, sort of the temple it is. But on the other hand, I kind of think there's, you know, a lot of that stuff is contextual, it's cultural, you know, it's probably brought over from our little Puritan brains, or God knows where it comes from. But I don't, it's necessarily that, oh, because you live a so-called spiritual life, that there's all these things that you deny to yourself. I think that it's just, it's a personal choice, and it's a subjective thing, and it's like, I would never do anything to consciously harm myself. I would never do anything to consciously harm somebody else, but that still gives you an awful lot of freedom.
Yeah.
Awful lot of room.
Well, they say the Buddha died from eating rancid pork, so what the heck, Gordon?
From what?
From eating rancid pork.
I don't like rancid,
I don't think he intentionally ate rancid pork, but someone offered it to him, and he didn't want to be impolite, so he ate it. And that's what killed him.
No,
so the story
that
goes. You mentioned, in terms of the TM cosmology of cosmic consciousness, God consciousness, unity consciousness, you mentioned cosmic consciousness and experiences which would characterize God consciousness, these subtle perception, angels, and all that stuff.
Sure.
What has there been in your experience that pertains to unity consciousness as it was described to you?
So if I had to kind of think about a progression, I'd say that CC thing happens, and like I said, I really can't relate to it, so I can't really talk about it that much. And then I think that kind of God consciousness, it seems like an awfully big term, very subtle and simple experience, but they say it's sort of being able to perceive the finest relative. Well, in order to do that, there has to be some recognition. You know, the world does change as a result of those kinds of experiences. If you're going to see, you know, molecules or angels or whatever, there has to be some change in my thinking, maybe an opening in the heart. And the reason that I mentioned that, the reason I'm going there, is I think that's really where that sort of unity thing comes in. And again, these seem like awfully big words for awfully simple experiences, you know. I mean, people say, oh, unity and this kind of thing. And it's like, whatever. I guess I'm a little bit cynical about all of that hierarchy and all of that kind of thing, which is probably a little bit hypocritical for me, because I certainly use it as a useful device and bunch of concepts and all that, but now, you know, higher states of consciousness, they just don't mean anything to me.
Well, I think it's valuable, I think, to hear you say that, because here in Fairfield, where, you know, we have a couple thousand people who have been meditating for decades, there's a certain subset of the population of meditators whom I believe tend to glorify higher states of consciousness to the skies. and, you know, who have this sort of grandiose notion of what they are, who are probably well along in the experience of those stages of human development themselves, but who fail to recognize that because they've kind of constructed such a lofty notion of what they are.
Right.
So they think this couldn't possibly be referring to my experience.
Right.
I'm still some kind of a slug, you know, and this is something which I might as well give up on for this lifetime and get it sometime later on. But actually, one of my initial thoughts in deciding to do this interview series was that I might dispel that notion in some people, that they might say, hey, wait a minute, you know, this guy's an ordinary Joe like me, and he's having this experience, and wait a minute, I'm having this experience too. The same thing he's describing, I can see that in myself. And so maybe, in fact, Marshy used to say, I refer to Marshy a lot because we both have that background, but he used to say that kind of the highest stages of, or the final stages of development in consciousness have to do with shifting your understanding. To me, that means getting a clear recognition of something that's actually been there all along, but that you had been overlooking.
Well, and I think that with, just like with any experience that is repeated, there's going to be reflection on that experience, and the experience then becomes clearer and clearer and clearer. And I just want to say one thing that I almost feel like I have to make a cautionary statement here, because I remember one thing that happened to me when I did get deeply involved with the TM organization, but it could have been anybody, you know, it could have been the Moonies or whatever, you know, floated my boat at the time, just happened to be TM, because of the authentic basis of the experience. So, I mean, there was something to it. But the thing that I remember that I found myself consciously doing, and it was really an effort, was that from the time I got the Cindy's, and I don't know whether that was why that was such a boundary, but maybe it was just that I was a little bit older. I think I was 26 or something like that. It was for me a time to begin looking at these areas in my life, and like I said, I had tried to be good, you know, kind of won't smoke this, won't do that, won't act in this way, really want to dance, you know, this kind of thing. And I used to actually force myself to do these desires that I had. Like, I had this desire in my mind, you know. I was kind of like, you know, typical dorky high school kid, sort of ran with the, you know, the hippie crowd or whatever. But I always wanted to dance, you know, just always wanted to. It's like when music gets going, you know, your body just wants to move, you know. Probably why I put a lot of drums in my music now. But anyway, always to do that. So I consciously, I mean, I remember this. I made a decision. I rode my little moped out to this club where there was a live band and nobody was dancing, you know. And these were couples and stuff. Shit, I was by myself. So I just kind of closed my eyes. I mean, I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't drinking anything or anything like that. But I just kind of closed my eyes because I was very self-conscious. And I just walked out on the dance floor and I just let my body start to move to the music, you know. So I would do these kinds of things that I thought were, you know, possibly antithetical to higher states of consciousness. And I would force myself to do them because these desires were in me. And I thought, you know, if I don't get these desires out there, if I don't express them, if I don't try to express them, nothing's going to happen to me. I'm just going to be locked. I'll go crazy. I'll be very unhappy. And so I used to just force myself to do these things. So now, you know, I live a comfortable, integrated life in the real world. And if that means that I have a steak or a bottle of wine or whatever, that's what it means.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with how fast I got here or how liberated I feel or anything else. And I think that people, maybe because we come from a material culture, maybe it's because of the traditions of the East that came over, but there's all of this stuff like, you know, shouldn't do this, shouldn't do that, shouldn't do that, shouldn't do that, and shouldn't do that. And it's like, excuse me, but that's bullshit. You know, you can do anything you want. As long as it feels to you as if you are progressing on your path and you're being true to yourself, it doesn't matter if somebody else is going to look at it and say, my God, what the hell are you doing? It's like, excuse me, but it's none of your business.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very personal thing.
Yeah, no, it's very good. I mean, I think it's a good point to make. And I don't think it's a prescription for anybody else. I think it's interesting that, you know, you have almost consciously willed yourself to be who you are. And it sounds to me like that's been kind of instrumental in your evolutionary development.
Yeah, absolutely. It has.
You uncork yourself, you know.
Well said. Well, gosh, thank you so much. It's been great.
Yeah,
it's been
fun. Thank you, Jim. I really appreciate your willingness to do this and your flexibility and all. I hope that the quality of this has been acceptable to people listening or watching, and we'll try to keep working on improving technical things. There's all kinds of glitches yet to work out in many phases of this operation. It's growing along, and I have some very good people helping me, giving advice. We've alluded to a chat group, and there's YouTube videos. There's a number of different facets of this, but there's one place from which you can find all this stuff, and that is batgap.com, batgap.com. If you go there, you'll see links to this chat group that Jim and I have been referring to and links to the YouTube videos and an archive of all the interviews that we have done so far. So however you're listening or to this or watching it, go there and you'll sort of see all the various possibilities. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you, Jim, for participating. And we will see you all next time.